Hello and welcome back to Enterprise Linux Security. I'm here as always with my good friend Zhao. How you doing?
Hello, Jay. As always, a pleasure being here with you. We're actually on the road now. We're, 3 weeks in a row where we actually meet the schedule, so things are looking good.
It's looking good. I don't have a course on me anymore to do. Like, it's 100% done, the Linux Essentials course, so I could literally say there's zero things to do. It's done. I would love to say it's out, but there's this approval process with Udemy. Apparently, they didn't like the word bonus video in one of the titles, so they kicked it back because of that. So at this point, if you want to take my Linux Essentials course, I'm there with you. I want you to be able to take it, but it's up to Udemy whenever that'll be released. But if you just check the website, learnlinux.tv, you'll see it there mentioned. It's most likely going to be today as of recording time that it'll be out. So really excited about that, just getting rid of some errata before we get started. And also just want to mention the Learn Linux TV merch shop. You can get an Enterprise Linux Security t-shirt there, a distro hopper shirt, apt install coffee t-shirt. There's a number of cool things there that you could check out, help support the channel. But what we're going to do today is not talk about t-shirts or Udemy courses. What we're going to do is talk about some security myths. We wanted to debunk these myths, and that's part of the reason we're choosing an easier topic, because we want to just kind of like ease into this, because I literally just wrapped the course yesterday. So here we are, fresh off of that, a new beginning, and what better way to start new beginnings by debunking things that aren't true?
Yeah, it seems like there's quite a lot of that going on in our job, so we'll be looking at some myths that people believe, both on the how to do the job and on the things that affect the job, if that makes sense. It's not just about the things that you do because you feel that that is right, but also things that you're subject to as part of the job that you also assume to be one way when they might not be that.
One thing I just want to say, and this is for anyone that's new to the podcast, because I feel like this is a good podcast to get started on. If you're new, security is really exciting. The hacks aren't always that exciting. Like you think about hacking, like in the movies, you know, you see someone that, you know, really cool looking person just crunching codes and, you know, 3D graphics flying by, and there's all these algorithms, and it could just simply be, as we'll talk later, you know, as we've talked in the podcast before, someone just calling someone up on the phone and just politely asking them for their password. So, and of course, that's going to be one of the myths that we're going to get into, but I think this is important to kind of set the stage. And when we bust myths in security, it's not just about the job. It's about understanding what security is and what threat intelligence is, like in actuality, and not just how Hollywood wants you to believe it. But at the same time, as one of Zhao yours that you're going to bring up, it's very important when it comes to, you know, there's misconceptions about job security that are at play here that we'll talk about later. So we have a lot to unpack.
Yes, we do. So let's take it from the top. It's very easy to believe that when you're handling cybersecurity, the only thing that matters is the technical skills. You need to be really good, you need to be a good pen tester, or you need to do amazing things with scripts and learn how to code and all of that. The majority of the job actually involves telling stories and talking to people. It's not about the technical skills themselves. And it's actually very easy to fall into this trap. This is especially true when you follow lots of people on Twitter, for example, that focus on cybersecurity, and all you see being posted are new tools or people discussing new attack vectors or people discussing new methodologies and all of that. And it all sounds very technically interesting and very relevant and all of that. But in the real world, what's most important is that you need to convince people to stop using password as password and stop clicking links in emails. And that's not a tool that's going to fix that. It has to be you convincing people of why it's important not to do those things. As we saw on last week's episode, when we looked at the Verizon's data breach investigation report, the top three attack vectors are phishing by a large margin, password brute forcing or password stuffing, and then unpatched vulnerabilities. Of these ones, the only one that's actually just technical is patching vulnerabilities. The other two, it's people problem. It's soft skills that you need to handle.
Right. So I guess what we're really trying to drive home is that to be a hacker, or I should say a threat actor, because I hate the word hacker applied to this kind of thing. So I'll say threat actor. You don't need any technical experience, as Jia was saying. You just need to know how to make a phone call. That's the only skill that you need. Now, granted, if you have technical skills, then, you know, someone in an evil line of work would do better because they have those skills. But when it comes to threat actors, you know, they're basically just picking up the phone. It's literally that simple. Now, there's obviously some very complex hacks that we talk about on this podcast, and we do that because they're noteworthy, they're newsworthy, they're education worthy, or there's some reason why we want to talk about them. They're noteworthy. That's the thing that we really want to make stand out here. We talk about the noteworthy stories. If we talked about all of the stories that happen like per minute, as the article says, that said a ridiculous number of personal hacks per minute was happening, it would be a very boring podcast because most of our stories would be, you know, Fran in New York had her bank account hijacked because someone asked for a password and she gave it to him. I mean, that's not a very exciting story, but when we look at what security actually is, you're going to find situations like that the majority of the time. And that's what the article is saying. 89% is the social engineering.
And that word that you used there, noteworthy, it's actually spot on. It's noteworthy because it's different from the majority of the attacks, as you were saying. All the other attacks focus just on sending emails to as many people as possible waiting for somebody to click on a link. And at that point, if you have somebody working on your organization that isn't fully aware or doesn't really understand it or is just overwhelmed with emails and doesn't pay enough attention as that person should be paying and clicks the link, it doesn't really matter the rest of the technology stack that you have protecting the organization because it's already inside of the perimeter. So, yeah. That's why... Again, this is what you're faced with when you're doing the job, but it's also something that's relevant for you if you want to do the job. Learning soft skills, and we've said this in the past, learning soft skills like storytelling, like writing good reports, like being able to take a lot of data from different sources, a lot of logs, a lot of information about the users and all of that, and create a compelling story that you can then use an example or that you can show to your superiors or whoever, or that you can use as a use case that shows the problem. All of that is just as important as knowing the actual technical details of how to do the job.
Yep, absolutely. And I think the biggest reason why this works it's not a bad thing when it comes to interpersonal skills, but it can be on the internet. We want to think the best of everyone, you know, and obviously that's not true of every person, but I'm just saying we always want to think the best. You know, we get a email from someone that says, you know, they've fallen on hard times and they need some money to help them out of a jam. And someone might say, well, I've been in a jam. Maybe I want to help this person out. But the person is, you know, sitting on a yacht in the middle of the ocean somewhere sipping martinis and they're having no trouble at all. But we want to think the best of people, and which compassion is a great thing. But when it comes to security, it's really not, because these people are not trying to help you or themselves anything other way than fattening up their bank account at your expense. And that's really what it comes down to.
The Nigerian prince scam. It's so successful because people fall for it. That's the hard evidence of it. If it wasn't successful, it wouldn't be used as an attack. So, yeah.
Absolutely. Now, we talk a lot about businesses, and in this article that I found for this podcast, it talks about the myth that only businesses need to worry about cyber attacks. So the only thing that a threat actor needs is to want something of value to themselves, whatever it is, whether it's intelligence about a company, whether it's someone's bank account or their Apple account or their Twitter handle. I mean, we've seen people hack other people, and there's a famous story about this if you Google it, where someone hacked a journalist and basically erased their entire online identity just because they wanted their Twitter handle. That's it. That's all. It wasn't motivated to get rich. The individual had a really great username and they wanted it and they did it, and to cover their tracks, they wiped the person's MacBook, iPad, all the stuff to cover the tracks. And that's such a one-off case, but if you think about the fact that there's billions of people on the planet, the whole point of a whole idea of a one-off case hitting you doesn't necessarily seem as rare as you might think, especially considering a lot of these attacks are bots. They're scanning the net for open ports, and it's often not about you, but becomes about you. And sometimes it's not about where you work or what your business title is, as it can be. It's about, you know, you. There's an opening. Someone saw it. They went for it. And sometimes that's really as simple as it is.
Value is a very subjective thing. You might think that you don't have anything of value for a potential attacker, but, well, you might have your email credentials and you might have worked at a different company. You might still store some information that you shouldn't keep, but you still have on your hard disk somewhere. And for some people, that might be valuable. On the other hand, it doesn't really matter if it's valuable or not. For some types of attacks and for some attackers, this is a numbers game. Try as many potential targets as possible, you'll be hitting a small percentage of that large number, but that will still amount to something. And whatever payback you get from that is still better than what you started with, which was zero. So any gain is a gain for a potential attacker. So value in itself might not necessarily play a role as a motivation there. Overall, it's not just your value that they're trying to extract, it's the value of all the attackers, of all the victims that they're hitting.
Now, there's one I just want to kind of cross off the list. I'm jumping ahead a bit here on the list if anyone's following along from the article, but I just felt like this is kind of one of the easier ones. I just wanted to kind of cross off, unless you have something more to add to this, but we talk about strong passwords. You have to have strong passwords and firewalls, and we don't really talk about antivirus much, but the myth is that there's a capability that you can have a, you know, insert name of application here, software, service, antivirus, whatever, have it installed, and then you're fine. And the article uses the like a guard dog mentality. Like, some people think that they have these things, that there's a guard dog there that helps keep people away. But that's just really not the way that this works. And the thing that we try to drive home in the podcast, and we've said this, is that if there was a product that would make somebody 100% unhackable, you better bet every billboard in the entire world would be advertising this product, okay? And they would be absolutely using this against all of their competitors, and everybody would know about it because they would make sure about it. And there's a reason why we don't have a product like this. And we have so many security companies making security products that, you know, even overlap at times, because if there was a one-size-fits-all security solution, we wouldn't even have a podcast, let alone, you know, what the article is talking about.
There are no magic bullets here. If there were any, there wouldn't be any competition. It would be just that one and everybody would use it. That doesn't exist. There isn't 100% protection from anything by any solution. And if this is actually a good thing that you need to understand when you're going, for example, in a negotiation with a potential, I'm missing the word here. And a potential vendor that you might want to engage with. If they're promising that they're going to solve all your problems and then still handle you some coffee or something like that, that's not possible. That's never going to happen. Don't believe them. There's no such thing as 100% bulletproof security. That's why cybersecurity is so hard, because if there was that solution, you just deploy it and, again, like you said, we'd move on. That doesn't exist. Strong passwords, firewalls, and antivirus are all I need. No, that's just the bare minimum with which you should start the conversation. That will catch the most basic stuff that goes your way. It will absolutely not catch everything. Even better than strong passwords, use multi-factor authentication. That would solve the password and credential stuffing and all of that problem.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, good point. Glad you brought that up. So another myth that the article brings up, and I also agree with this, and we've talked about this before, which is why I think this is a great jumping on episode for someone getting started, and it's that security is solely the responsibility of the IT department. And according to the article, I kind of agree with this. I think there's some, you know, asterisk here, but there was a time where there really was that divide. You know, you had IT handling, you know, their side of it, and they had employees doing whatever they do. And there was that wall, and everyone understood everything goes through IT, everything's purchased through IT, the security's through IT. And it's not that it's not that way now, because that mentality still is the case. And yes, it is the IT's department, you know, they're the first line of defense. Well, actually, maybe not the first line of defense, wrong choice of words. But they're, you know, it's their critical responsibility, but it's not only their responsibility. And we use examples like somebody picking up a flash drive. Oh, a free flash drive. Cool. I don't have to buy a flash drive now. They find it in a parking lot and they plug it into their computer. And the next thing they know, there's malware all over their network. And, you know, it's not like IT is going to be like checking everyone's pockets on the way inside the building to make sure that nobody does that. And even if they did, then maybe somebody would do something else that, I mean, it's just this, it's become this never ending, you know, much bigger problem that the only way that it can be solved is for all of us to be on the same team. And considering the fact that we have myths to debunk means that there's, it's not stigmas, it's like this mentality that if IT is asking someone to do something, it's going to be a lot of work and it's going to be super complicated and all of this. And I feel like some of these myths that we're reading right now kind of plays into, you know, this mentality that the IT department, they handle all of this. But it's really, and I think this is also why it's really hard to change the conversation to it's everyone's responsibility. We've been trying to change this conversation for years. I feel like we're kind of stuck on this mentality.
It's actually a historic thing. When organizations started to have an IT department, it was like 3 decades ago, 4 if you worked at some place special. But around that time, early 90s, late 80s, around the 80s, somewhere around there, you started to have these large IT departments inside of companies. And you need to understand that at that time, the majority of people had no experience in IT whatsoever. There were no mobile phones, there was no way for you to interact with something that was technologically relevant. There was no internet, there were no threats like there are today. So it was actually easy to understand that the only people that should be handling IT were the people with the experience and the know-how to do that, because the vast majority of the people that worked inside the organization had no experience whatsoever. And that stuck, and that stuck until today, when we have most everybody has a mobile phone, everybody interacts with the internet daily or hourly or every minute if they are always looking at their phones. And people have some know-how on how things operate on the IT level. Even if they don't consider themselves knowledgeable on IT, they know much more today than the same people doing their job did 20 years ago or 30 years ago. It's just something that you've always been doing and you don't consider it to be that relevant or that important, but it is. And with that explosion of knowledge and of devices and of interactions and all of that, the threat profile grew for the organization. So you now don't just have this set of people that have the know-how both to defend but also to cause problems, but everybody can cause problems. Everybody can cause problems either by clicking on phishing emails, as we said before, but also because they brought their device that has malware on it, or that they think they know how to use a specific tool and they actually don't, and they don't configure it properly. All of these different behaviors, they led to an environment where everybody needs to know enough to handle some part of the security problem, or else the whole organization is just the IT department, because there's no way to monitor every action by every single user. There are environments that are extremely restrictive, and they are restrictive because they had problems in the past that forced them to be that restrictive. But that's really a poor environment to be in. And that's really a poor environment to work in, because you're always restricted on what you use and what you can do and what you can visit and what emails you can see and all of that. So there has to be a balance. But having that balance and achieving that balance means that you need to understand that there's also some best practices, and we hate that word here, but there are some practices that you need to do in order to be secure, even if you're not in the IT department. So the average user must understand the security of what they're browsing and how that can affect the organization. they must not plug that random USB drive that they caught on the parking lot when they were coming into work that day. All of those things, it's not the IT guy that's going to be looking over your shoulder and looking at what you're doing. It has to be innate behavior that you learn and you understand why it's relevant, and then you do it throughout the day.
Yep, I have complete agreement. And speaking of users, this myth is not surprising, but I kind of feel like it is going to be for a lot of people when the myth is that cyber attacks are an external threat. It can, a cyber attack can be, certainly, we talk about many of them, you know, the noteworthy ones, as I said earlier, but according to this article, 75% of cyber attacks are inside jobs. And, you know, consider, of course, that, you know, the date the article is written and other reports that we've brought up on the podcast, and we brought up a report last week. So obviously there could be some more current information that could show the percentages being higher or lower. But what we generally find is that the usual suspects are on every single one of these lists. And inside threats for cyber attacks is not a rare thing to see. And so we need to really frame this like, you know, we spend so much time protecting ourselves from what's on the outside that we don't even look at what's at home. Like, and one example of this is that, and this was like probably 10 or 15 years ago, where I was at a diner, actually a restaurant. And after I left the restaurant, there was some fraudulent transactions. There were two of them that were tried against my credit card. Now, what it ended up being, long story made short, is that when I gave my card to the waiter to take it back to, you know, pay for the order, they must have wrote down the card number, called a friend that worked at a store, tried to run the card number and buy a TV, okay? At no point was this a password issue. At no point, this was someone on the inside, okay, that was stealing money. This wasn't someone from the outside, and this is my main point, hacking into their systems and stealing credit card numbers. This was a waiter that was taking information on the inside. And that was like one of the ones that hit me personally. But we see this often where you could have an employee be disgruntled and they want to get back. But sometimes it's not even that. And I don't think a lot of these articles do a good job of talking about this. A lot of times inside jobs are purely accidental. Someone, you know, accidentally hits the delete key on something and deletes something that they shouldn't have deleted, or there's all kinds of different things that can happen, but we really do need to keep an eye on what's on the inside. Accidents can happen, disgruntled employees, it's a real thing. We need to look at the big picture.
I think there's a bit more to that. Different industries will suffer from this at varying degrees, but I worked in the past in higher education. I was on the IT department at the university here. One of the problems that we faced was that the majority of the attacks were not coming from the outside. We had all perimeter firewalls and everybody and everything was segregated and all of that, but the students themselves were on the inside. They weren't passing through the perimeter firewall to reach the systems. And we had IT courses, we had computer science courses and computer science degrees and all of that. So we had a lot of people really interested in learning about hacking, and because it's very glamorous and all of that. And where were they going to try their newly acquired skills? Obviously on the internal systems at the university. So most of the threats were not coming from the outside, but were coming from overeager students. And different industries will suffer from this at varying degrees, as I said. But everywhere where you have, say, your customers or your patients, if you're in healthcare, or I don't know, if you're on retail, your customers when they are inside the store, their level of connection there is not the same as the customer reaching the online store. So they will be coming in through a different part of the network. Is that part of the network fully segregated? Is there a perimeter firewall that's covering that? Is it in the DMZ? However you have that segregated, it's important to realize that the attacks not only come from the outside, because, again, it's like that movie trope, the phone call is coming from inside the house, and it applies directly here.
Yep, complete agreement. So have you tested your backups lately? Because that's something we keep bringing up on the podcast a lot. I mean, you brought up, because I know what you're going to say ahead of time, but I have to say, I really wish the last point you're about to make with the myths that you found, I mentioned at the beginning, is my favorite, because I think it very well might be my favorite of the podcast, and I'll mention why when we get to it. But you brought up three that you have on your list. So what about backups? Do they always work?
Yeah. If you have a backup of something and you fully trust that backup and you haven't tested it, it doesn't work. You should never act upon the assumption that the backup that just finished and finished successfully according to whatever program you're using to run the backup. Do not trust it implicitly. Until you test, until you try to recover data from it and it works, that backup should not be trusted. And I see over and over again people just blindly trusting and doing ops on top of systems just because they have backups and can restart the backups. When that fails, and when something goes wrong, it's the absolutely worst moment where you want to be doing the work and doing the backup restore and having it fail. You have a system that you assume was not going to fail, it fails, and then your backup also fails. That's a really poor situation to be in.
I feel like without even realizing it, you know, sometimes we're looking for the peace of mind and not the actual thing. We want to know that we did the backup, but doing the work to test it, we need to do that too, and it's not as fun. But the peace of mind, it's a peace of mind issue, I think. We sometimes there's a false peace of mind or a premature peace of mind. You really do need to know if your backups work before you feel like everything is going to be okay, because believe me, it's stressful when you find out they're not. Believe me, it's not a good day.
And when I finish this three myths that I brought, there is a story that ties all of them together, and it's kind of relevant for all of them. The next one that I want to bring in is that if you follow the instructions, it will always work. Until it doesn't, and absolutely no, it doesn't always work. Either because you just missed something very small and you're following the instructions for, I don't know, the minor version prior to the one that you're actually deploying, or because it hasn't been updated with the latest information, or because whoever wrote the documentation had just drunk too much whiskey or something like that. Instructions are not foolproof. Just because you found a tutorial online that tells you how to do something, take it with a pinch of salt. You should run it in the lab environment and don't assume that it won't fail just because. It might, it will, and it will do so at the worst possible moment.
Yep, absolutely. And it's funny you brought that up, because doing YouTube videos, I run into this, you know, because it's like the ultimate version of this. Because imagine, I mean, it's one thing when you write an article or you write, I mean, not to say that's not a lot of work, because it's a lot of work. But when you have B-roll and audio engineering and you're a narrative around the instructions, at that point, it gets to be very, very, very annoying when that happens. But it's just part of the job description, I guess. But the point being that here I have an established thing that I was doing in rehearsal for a video like 10 times. And then when I hit the record button, I cannot tell you how many times it fails. It fails a lot. And then I can't explain it. It's like, and even in, when I've seen this happen in deployments at businesses, and this is more important when you're doing a deployment for a client, and you've done it in your test environment like a dozen times, and you have it down, right? And you've destroyed it and rebuilt it each time, and Murphy's Law comes in and something happens. It's the reason why we always have a backup plan in every single deployment, or at least you should, when it comes to any delivery in IT. You should always have a plan B to get it back to the way it was, to rewind and go back to the way, fall back, because no matter how many times you practice, you might actually need to move it backward. And the thing is, it sucks when that happens, but I feel that it's more responsible to tell the client that, you know, we have to roll it back because there was a, you know, unintended side effect, rather than, okay, we're fixing it. We don't know what to do. It's completely broken. It's being able to say, you know, we set it back to the way it was. We're going to get together and we're going to figure this out. And then get back to the client and tell them what you found. This is something that happens like constantly. So I'm glad you brought that one up.
And don't get me wrong. I'm not just talking about tutorials or information or whatever. just done, written by some rando on the internet. I'm talking about official product documentation by the vendor themselves. It's not always right. It's not always accurate. There are mistakes. It's written by people. People can make mistakes, either intentionally or not. It doesn't really matter. This is something that you'll run into doing the job, and again, it will trip you over, and it's a very interesting learning moment there.
It really is. I ran into this also when I was, for a job, I was learning Azure, and like you see, like the instructions always work, and I'm thinking, like, when do they? Because like it's one thing for a blogger to have a mistake, that's fine, but when you have like Microsoft and Azure documentation, literally, and they, you know, change the interface to a new version, you know, just a UI refresh, and nothing in their documentation matches at all. Like you, like anything you look up, how you add a certificate, how you add a user to your domain, how you do any of these things is completely different, and none of the documentation works. Yes, it's something. It's not only that what you're saying, because you follow the instructions that it's always going to work every time, is when something can actually go wrong when the documentation doesn't change. But in addition, sometimes the documentation is confusing before you get to that point. It's the struggle's real.
And the last one that I want to bring up is that you can't make mistakes or you're fired. You can't make mistakes in cybersecurity or you're fired. And that's not true. Everybody would be out of a job by now. There was this person on Reddit, I don't know, last week or something like that, on the sysadmin subreddit. And that person mentioned that he had made the biggest mistake ever and was afraid of losing his or her job. This was at a bank. And apparently, there had been some change to a production system without making a snapshot of the virtual machine. And because there were backups, obviously, and the instructions were simple and easy to follow. And this is going to tie into all the three that I just mentioned. Obviously, he assumed, or that person assumed, there was no chance to fail. Now, Murphy's Law being Murphy's Law, the process failed. It impacted customer visible systems. And when he went to recover from backup, the backup was about 4 terabytes. It was over 24 hours restore. And it failed almost at the end. So he was left without a production system, without a backup, and without a rollback plan. And the proverbial cherry on top here, and that person was going to discuss a raise that week or the next. So absolutely, at the last moment, no backup, no production system, and you're on your own. That person was assuming he was going to be fired. Now, there are quite a few things to unpack here. First, everybody makes mistakes. It's impossible not to. The system, the environment is just too complex not to make mistakes. If you're fired because you did something like this once, then it's a really poor work environment anyway, and you're not missing out on much. Mm-hmm. You just found a way that your processes are broken. You need to come up with a way for this not to happen again. And trust me, you'll never make this mistake again. This is that learning experience side of things. When you go through something like this, you'll never fall for the same mistake again. So, yeah. Now you're in a position where you can go to your boss or something and say, okay, I broke this and I'm doing this to fix it. And we should change our operation so that the next time that there has to be a change in the production system, we always enforce the snapshots, or we make the snapshots come up automatically every X amount of hours, or we test the backups every single day, or something like that. And all of those are improvements. So it's not that you failed and you're going to be fired. You just improve the way that your operations can be done. If whoever you're working with does not understand that, again, it's not the right environment to be working in anyway. You're not losing too much.
You know, you've said it exactly spot on. That's exactly why I wanted, or that's my favorite, because this is something that, I mean, it is terrifying to tell your employer, you know, something has gone wrong, but it is part of the job. But at the same time, you know, like you were saying, if your work culture is such that you're afraid of making one mistake, and I have worked at these jobs too, I know how that feels. I've done that. I've been there. There are jobs out there, many of them, that will treat you well and will, you know, appreciate you. So you just got to keep looking for it. And it's easy to feel like you're stuck in a job or this or that. You know, you got to be happy at work, and you have to feel like you're, you know, a part of the process and that your opinions are respected, but more importantly, that you're not walking on eggshells and you're not just one slip up away from the unemployment line. That's just no way to live. It just really isn't.
And obviously you shouldn't be doing these things on production, but you assume that the documentation is right and you assume that it will work. Again, lots of assumptions that went wrong there. But still, it's something that can and does happen. Production systems go down for everybody. It's not just you at your organization that makes a mistake. Microsoft has systems going down. Google has systems going down. Amazon has systems going down. If these guys can't make it, can't get it right every time, there's no expectation that you should get it right every time either. So don't assume that you can't make mistakes. And this is true just for regular sysadmin operations, but just as well for cybersecurity. You will never catch every single threat that comes your way. Someday, something will get through. It's how you handle the fallout and how you learn from it and how you improve things afterwards that really define if you're a good professional or not. It's not the fact that something actually got through. There's no bulletproof way to avoid it.
And even if you did manage to be perfect, which is impossible, but let's just assume you just haven't had your first mistake yet, all it's going to take is for Cloudflare or AWS to go down, and then that's enough to cause it. And it's not your fault that they went down. All you got to do is just be using one vendor that just has one problem at no fault of yours. Everything can come, you know, can go falling over. You know, you have a certain number of data centers down at a cloud provider, you know, good luck. I mean, even it's not like you work at the cloud provider. What are you going to do about it? Nothing. But, you know, this is why we have, you know, backups, and we keep talking about this, and we also have different regions and things. But there's always an answer to everything, but it's just impossible to think of everything ahead of time. And it's impossible, as you're saying, Zhao, to have that attention to detail because the systems are that complex. But at the end of the day, if you feel like you're one slip up away from being fired, I mean, that's not healthy.
The pressure in the job is really through the roof. You don't need to pile up on that. The fact that, am I going to lose my job? Am I going to lose my job? Working under those conditions is a surefire way to make mistakes. Again, not the right environment if that's where you're stuck in, and I'm sorry if it is. But there are better places out there to work.
Yep, and I have worked at them. I can be the one to tell you. There's definitely light at the end of the tunnel, and it's a very bright light. So if you just keep your eyes out there, you never know. But yeah, so I think those were all the ones that I wanted to mention. Anything on your end, John?
No, I'm done. I think we covered the most important ones and the ones that I wanted to mention as well. Hope this helps somebody. And again, try not to make too many assumptions when you're facing a new situation. It might not be as bad or as good as it seems, so pay attention, do your job. If something fails, then learn from it and improve the next time. And thank you very much for joining, and until the next one.
See you next time.